Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the New Books Network in Education, a podcast on the New Books Network. My name is Max Jacobs. I'm a second-year doctoral student in education at Rutgers University. Today, I'm interviewing Mirasi Velasquez, author of the book Puerto Rican Chicago, Schooling the City, 1940 to 1977, published by the University of Illinois Press. To get us started, Mirasi, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, thank you, Max, for inviting me to join you and be in conversation with you today. And it's a nice feeling to know that people are still thinking and reading and engaging with the book, you know, 2 years after it was published. I'm a historian of education, but primarily I'm a Latino studies, Latinx studies scholar. That's my home department now that I'm at the University of Illinois. And, you know, like I to tell my students, I'm a storyteller, right? And part of the work that I do is my hope in the work that I do is to help our communities tell their stories too. So even though I'm a historian of education, really intellectually, but then also personally, my home is in Latino studies.
Thank you for sharing that. And I think to that point, in the acknowledgments of the book, you thank numerous people. But one person stood out to me that you thanked, which was Miss Rosa Navarro, your elementary school teacher. And I was wondering if we could just start the conversation today, just talking about her, the impact that she had on you. And then also, you mentioned that she created a classroom space where your identity as a Puerto Rican child was celebrated. So if we could just kind of reflect on what Miss Navarro did to do such a thing, and also the impact that she may have had on you as a scholar, but also as a storyteller.
I think it says a lot about an educator that decades later, once you leave those classrooms, that you're still thinking and reflecting and thinking, right? Individuals have impacted your life in these spaces. And so my second or first year when I was at the University of Oklahoma, I wrote a short piece for a community newspaper or magazine in Chicago about why I study the schooling history of Puerto Ricans in Chicago, which is my home community. And here I am writing this in Oklahoma, right? Reflecting on my own relationship to my work, but also missing home. And the first thing I thought about was why I'm here doing this work. It's because in second grade, I walked into Ms. Navarro's classroom. Mm-hmm. And so for the first time, I was in a space where someone knew how to pronounce my name, Mirasi, right? Someone greeted me in a way in which I knew that at least for those few hours of the day, I was going to be loved and cared for in a classroom setting and literally celebrated, right? Especially as a Puerto Rican child attending school in the years that followed the second Division Street uprising, which ends my book, actually. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote that piece and I talked about her, and it wasn't my intention to spend that much time talking about her. But fast forward, the piece came out again in a local, you know, community newspaper, and I had just walked back to my office and there was a voice message, right, waiting for me. And when I pressed play, the first thing that, you know, the voice I heard was, "Mira en sí que nombre bello," which is how she used to greet me every single day. And so apparently a former colleague of hers read the piece and said, "Rosa, I think they're talking about you in this piece." And she's like, "Oh my gosh, I have a unique name." And so she remembered me, right? But she also remembered me, right, as a child. I had her for three years, and I was in her classroom for 3 years. And so from that moment forward, you know, when I was coming to the city, you know, to visit home, to do my research, I would meet with her, and, you know, she would cook me meals, and, you know, I spend time with her. And this year, it's probably because I moved and I, you know, didn't keep up with my Christmas card list. It's probably the first year that we didn't exchange Christmas cards. And I actually need to dig up her new address to write to her and let her know that I'm back, you know, in the city. And so we reconnected, right? And I still call her, you know, I'll still call her, you know, I can't call her by her name. And so, you know, when I see her, you know, I feel like that child that walked into that classroom and someone believed in me, but then also loved me as a student, right? And so I actually did an oral history of Ms. Navarro. There's a project I eventually want to return to on the history of Puerto Rican teachers that were recruited to teach in Chicago in the mid-70s, right? In the time period that I end my book, that was not, according to the, you know, Chicago Board of Education, it wasn't a formal program. But when you talk to people that were recruited through it, it was a formal program, right? The Puerto Rican teachers that were coming, and they're recruiting them to teach in schools where our population was in higher numbers in the 70s, and nobody wanted to teach us, right, in these spaces. And so she came, so she shared her history of how she got to the city. And it was an accidental event. You know, she was on the beach one day with a friend. She had just graduated from college and saw a sign that said Chicago schools recruiting teachers. And so they went in their bathing suits, you know, to the table and said, "Hey, how do we apply?" And they're like, "Well, we're interviewing people now." And they just looked at how they were dressed and they're like, "Wow, I shouldn't be interviewing." And they're like, "Don't worry about it, just interview." And she got hired that week. Wow. And within a few weeks, she was on a plane to Chicago to enter Chicago schools, right? Public schools. And then fast forward a few years, I walk into her classroom, right? And so, you know, she's not just important to me as an individual, but when I think about community histories, she and the other educators that came to Chicago in the 1970s became part of that community. And so even in for folks who do contemporary work around educational justice or just teacher education, you know, the what people are talking about now is grow your own teacher programs. Well, we were doing that already, right? We were educating our own educator. You know, Black Indigenous communities were doing that in the 19th century, right? You know, Latino communities were doing that too once we start entering schools in high numbers. But now people are paying attention. You know, I recently read a piece about how, you know, it makes sense for teachers to spend multiple years with students in their classrooms because they build relationships with the community, family, and those students. Well, Ms. Navarro was doing this on her own in the 1970s and 80s, and nobody was talking about her, giving her credit. And she told me that I did it because I knew that I needed you all for a little longer to be able to cultivate the kind of teaching and learning I wanted to do with you all so that you'll go on and believe in yourselves when it comes to schools. But then I knew how they treated me, my coworkers, my principal, where my identity was invalued. And I was afraid if I let you go, what would happen to you? And so all of these things that people were talking about, here's this Puerto Rican teacher that's doing it in Chicago. And I know that's a long-winded response, but when I think about where the book came from, it came from me walking into this classroom. But besides that, it came from this young woman taking a chance and applying for a job in a city that she was unfamiliar with. And then, you know, being placed, she didn't even choose that school. She actually was in train. She was going to be in a secondary school. She accidentally ended up being placed in an elementary school that then I enter. And it was in the heart of the community that just, you know, a few years before was at the center of one of the largest urban uprisings that centered Puerto Rican communities.
Yeah, I've just found it inspiring, you know, that you included her, and it just hearing you speak about her, I think it speaks a lot to the themes that are in the book as far as identity construction, schooling. And one of the things that really stood out to me was the connection between the island of Puerto Rico, Chicago, and the the apparatus of schooling and its relation to colonization. And that seems to be a centerpiece of the thesis that you drive home in the book. And I was wondering if you could just expand a little bit about the connections you see between the time, places, and spaces. I know it's a large question, but you know, how they prefigure, I guess, in the schooling and the colonization and their relationship.
You know, it's one of those things that, you know, the book had to get finished. Well, the dissertation had to get finished and the book had to get finished. When I think about like what I wish I would have
done. Gives me inspiration.
It happens. And so I think about like what I wish I would have spent maybe a lot more time on. But then the book probably would have been like twice as long, you know. And so it really was on expanding that conversation on colonization and schooling, right? And I'm doing that a little more right now in some work that, you know, that I'm developing, right? Really looking at applying the lens of settler colonialism to the archipelago, which is not done. Mm-hmm. And so there's actually just maybe like two other Puerto Rican scholars that I'm hearing now in our intellectual spaces having that conversation. But when we're thinking about settler colonialism, we think, you know, rightfully so, right? We're thinking about indigenous communities and we're talking about engaging in, you know, decolonizing these educational spaces, but then also larger communities. But it should also be applied and can be applied to the archipelago, right? To Puerto Rico. And so when I think about the beginnings of education in Puerto Rico, it's the beginning of U.S. colonization of Puerto Rico, right? Del Moral does it beautifully, or at least starts that conversation in her book, Negotiating Empire, where she looks at, you know, the early decades of Puerto Rican or education in Puerto Rico, right? And looking at schooling, looking at teacher education, but then also looking at the relationship of, or using the language of colonialism and thinking about our communities, right? And so, what happens, you know, day one, basically, is that the U.S. revamps, the military, but along with that, education, right? And so the fact that you have the same people who are thinking about how to use Puerto Rico as a space, right? Puerto Rican bodies, right? As something to exploit, right? Mm-hmm. And looking at it through this very military lens, right? And they're applying the same language and same tools to education, tells you already what the intent was for Puerto Rico and for Puerto Ricans, right? The fact that, you know, and I talk a little bit about it in my book, but then also other folks do it too. The fact that, you know, Puerto Rican children, the Americanization tools that are being used on Puerto Rican students was the same one that you were using in places like Minnesota, like Michigan, like New York, on Eastern Europeans, right? On Southern Europeans. But then you're applying it to this population that's physically, one, they're non-citizens, right? Because Puerto Ricans aren't citizens until 1917. Citizens of anywhere, right? We're basically non-citizens, but who are physically removed and separated from these conversations, right? And it doesn't make sense. However, children are expected to kind of follow along, right? They have these almost like military parades that children enact, you know, in Puerto Rico. They're, you know, waving the American flags, you know, in their classrooms, and they're expected to co-sign to what's happening to them as children, right? And by extension, teachers are, you know, expected to do that as well. Puerto Rican teachers lose their jobs if they don't, you know, adapt to English language acquisition or teaching in their classrooms, right? And this is happening in rural communities, right? Who for the first time are seeing educational spaces within those spaces. And, you know, and I on one end, you know, it's good that education is expanding in Puerto Rico across the archipelago. But on the other hand, the intent of that education is dehumanizing in a lot of different ways, right? You know, what would Puerto Rican education have looked like if from day one, Puerto Ricans themselves would have been at the table to have conversations about what they want? But no, because the intent is to engage in conversations around colonization, creating unacceptable citizenry before they're even citizens, right? And applying a military lens in the way that you approach education in Puerto Rico tells you already the ways in which bodies are not part of that conversation. Children aren't going to be included in any kind of discourse. And then this happens in Hawaii, you know, and I'm excited for Derek Taira's book, you know, which will hopefully be out this year, because he's having the same conversation around territorial educational practices, right? And I think that's part of the theme, and it's something I want to do a little more digging and kind of have a conversation around, is that, you know, you have to apply or at least link Puerto Rico to what's happening in other territories. And I'm not talking about Guam. I'm not talking about those territories, right? But I'm talking about those territories that then become states, right? And so what's happening in Puerto Rico is similar to the way in which they were engaging conversation around Oklahoma and Indian Territory, right? Or the Southwest before they you know, get absorbed into statehood in Hawaii, right? And so how do you think about territorial law, right? Which is colonialism, you know, and apply it to these larger conversations. And so it's almost like that one thing that I wish it would have been like another chapter in the book. But then I think about, well, that's probably a project on its own to talk, to engage a little deeper in a conversation around settler colonialism and education. And, you know, and folks are already starting that conversation, and I love it, you know, that people are already thinking about it. And I think part of it is because we are in community with Indigenous scholars in our institutions too. And we're having these conversations, which when you're engaging with them and talking about how they're thinking about their scholarship in relationship to their community, you're sitting there like, well, this is also Puerto Rico, and why aren't we having the same conversation?
Yeah. And you know, I came about this book and became aware of it at HES's book panel with you and Derek on it. And I have to say, it was fascinating to hear you both speak or engage and exchange about the connections between this larger colonial project and schooling. And I remember leaving like really amped up about the future directions as far as where, you know, where we're headed as historians of education, as far as the larger questions that I think are starting to become louder in the room, which I think is important.
I think it also matters that now we're writing about our own communities, yeah, and we don't have outsiders doing it. And I know that makes people uncomfortable to hear. Yep. But positionality matters, right? Because we are, right, the generations that inherited, right, the system of education that was created to control and contain us, right? You know, we are the generations that our bodies are literal reminders of these colonial practices and processes that are still, that we're still fighting against, right? And so it matters that now you have, right, in history of education, a generation of scholars that are coming from the very communities that we're writing about. And so we're not approaching it in a way that that is going to erase the human aspect of the work that we're engaging in.
Yeah, yeah. And I think to that point, the field itself has, as you mentioned in the book, it lacks the Latino, Latina, Latinx experience. And I think that's one of the things this book offers is, you know, not only recording the experiences of Puerto Ricans in schooling, but also in activism. And I was wondering if you could just speak to why it is you seem to take a pretty broad understanding of what education is by looking to the streets as well as what's happening in the schools. So I was wondering if you could just speak to why it is you made that choice to include such a sustained focus on an activism, and also, you know, bringing the Latino identity to both of those spheres.
You know, it's the genealogies that we come from, right? You know, to come from communities that are constantly, one, you know, we're thinking about scholarly works, you know, live in the footnotes of history in one space, right? But then also our lived experiences are reflective of these, you know, historical and social processes that negate us a sense of humanity in school spaces, right? And so it makes sense that we're constantly resisting, you know, and resisting means so many different things. And so that's actually what I hope people get from the book too, is that even though you had so many different ideologies at play here, right? You know, Puerto Rico is a complicated conversation, right? Because, you know, there isn't any kind of agreement about our future, right? But the one thing that we agree on, even if ideologically and politically, we don't agree on the status of Puerto Rico and the relationship with the U.S., is that we want a future. But how do we, you know, write that future, and how do we work? And Chicago tells us that, right? The history of schooling tells us that what was happening in schools was going to trickle down to the community spaces and to literally to the streets of Chicago for our community. But this happens across other spaces, right? And so, you know, bringing in the community is important because we're not brought in so many different ways when we're talking about education. So those conversations are happening in the background, right? You know, it makes sense that a response to the Division Street uprising of 1966, a response is education, right? And some of these community leaders are saying that we needed to think about how we were going to respond. And at the core, we knew that schools had to be part of that conversation, right? And so then you have Mita Ramirez going to Antonia Pantoja and asking her if she can bring, you know, Aspira to Illinois, right? To Chicago specifically, right? You have these newspaper spaces, you have the Young Lords, right? That are viewed as a street gang, you know, but really are community activists, you know, at that point, having these conversations with young people, right? The fact, you know, I love looking and going back to the Young Lords newspaper because there's so many conversations in there about education and schooling that these young people can't have in schools themselves, right? And so it makes sense that you have to bring the community in if you're going to have an effective conversation around schooling and education, because we're viewed in contemporary times, we're viewed as a community that doesn't value education. But, you know, when you look at the history of education, at least, you know, the works are coming out from Latina, Latino, Latinx scholars. No, I'm showing you that for the last 150 years, when we're writing about our community history, schools are always part of the conversation, right? I'm thinking about Laura Munoz's new book, Desert Dreams, as part of that. I'm thinking about the numerous texts that Guadalupe San Miguel has, you know, has gifted us, you know, throughout the decades, right? That these are community histories, right? We're writing community histories. We are social historians. We are engaging with communities, but we're looking at schools formally, informally as a lens to talk about community building, to talk about activism. And Chicago, when it comes to history of U.S. education, you know, I have incredible colleagues that have done amazing work on Black education in Chicago, but very little has been written around Latina, Latino, Latinx education that we are able to kind of engage with in terms of our scholarship. But that is our history in the city, is one around schools and schooling. Angelica Rivera, I hope, you know, moves it into book form at some point, but wrote an incredible dissertation on Mexican-American women or Mexicanas in Chicago who are talking about schooling, right? Those oral histories are telling us that these mujeres, whether as mothers or as students themselves, we're always thinking about education. The problem is education doesn't think about us, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's what my hope is that starting this conversation about bridging, you know, community in conversation around schooling, that maybe it opens up, you know, a space for people to keep doing this type of work.
Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
I found the newspaper archives that you dived into were incredibly rich. As a site of education, but also as you're speaking to the internal debates between the different community activists that are out there and centering school, I just found that to be really interesting. Not something you hear about when you think about the Young Lords, right? Them debating schooling politics and all that stuff. So it was, you know, I thought the tapping of the newspapers as sites of education was just beautifully done. And another, you know, I think that you're just speaking to a little bit is gender politics plays a major role in this book. And I was wondering if you could just expand on the role of gender within this story, within schooling, within the Latino Latinx community. You know, I think that that's a major piece of this story that you tell.
And the interesting thing is that I didn't want to sell it as just as women's history book, right? Because yep. I wanted people to kind of make that connection on their own. In the book, right? And that, you know, the individuals I'm talking about are weaved throughout the text, right? You know, in terms of their relationship to space. And there are women. And part of that was intentional because when you look at the history of the community, there's always men who are highlighted as community leaders, right? Heck, even the history of Mirta Ramirez, right, who passed away in the last couple of years, I believe, there's men who try to discredit her and say, well, she's not the one that did it. We gave her the resources to do it. And it's like, you don't get it. You know, even the fact that you're saying, well, we gave her the money to go, you know, that you sent this young woman, you know, in the 1960s on a Greyhound bus across the country and don't think about the importance of her, mm-hmm. right? Her body being used in this way. And then being at the forefront of creating your organization, but you still want to take the credit away from her, right? And so even now, there's still people who don't want these women that I write about being at the forefront of telling the history of Puerto Rican Chicago, right? That you have Carmen Valentin, right? That even in the Puerto Rican independence movement, that, you know, that's very, it's very central in Chicago. She doesn't get highlighted in the same way that some of the men in the movement and you know, and everybody deserves the credit for the work that they've done. But even Carmen Valentin isn't given the space, right? And here's an educator, right? That probably, you know, when you think about, she lost her career, like, you know, for the work that she was doing, right? And was central to these conversations around school reform in the 1970s, right? Changing the curriculum, hiring more teachers, doing all of this, right? And then is in prison, you know, later on because of her work in the movement. But people don't talk about the importance of her body, right, in these spaces either. And so, you know, it's not surprising that this is happening in this, you know, within this community or in this historical moment. But my hope is that we start challenging that, right? And so we start thinking about how one, like a student in my class, you know, Latinos in the City class this semester just said in class the other day, gender should always be a point of analysis. And I'm like, exactly. Gender should always be a point of analysis, yeah. Because the way in which we experience, the way in which, you know, these community spaces and the way in which even these different relationships are cultivated in these spaces are always along these deeper, you know, gendered, you know, conversations, you know, especially for the ways in which history is written. And so it was really important to make sure that it wasn't just talking about women, but naming them across the text, right? Even when they were not in agreement with what needs to be done in the community, they still are important, right? And I'm thinking about Dina Davila's column, you know, in El Puerto Riqueño, and that, you know, people were just like, you know, she was kind of conservative. And I'm like, that's okay. You know, she kind of changes a little bit in the later columns of El Puerto Riqueño, but also she was, I believe she was an Afro-Puerto Riqueña, right? And so she's allowed to view the yeah. community the way that she needs to, because she's also at the receiving end on multiple levels, right? And she's someone that I'm super obsessed with because no one's written about her. There's like very few documents about her, but I always laugh because I've also been looking for this when I was in second grade, maybe third grade, when I was in I was a Girl Scout. I dropped out very early on once my sister, you know, grew out of it. But I got chosen to be, and I was, you know, like seven and cute and little, right? In my little uniform. But I got chosen by the community, but also by the Trina Davila Center in Chicago to greet and lead the color guard for the first, you know, woman mayor of Chicago, who's problematic, Jane Byrne, right? And so I've been looking for that image of me inside the Trina Davila Center, giving like, the, you know, like leading the color guard to Jane Byrne, right? In a community that's just, this is just a few years after the 1977 uprising, right? And so like all of these multiple connections, right? But very little has been written about this woman. And it makes sense to me because the point is to not highlight women's histories because they're not viewed as community leaders in their little spaces, right? And so my hope is that at least by naming them across the text, it grounds our contributions, but then also our history in ways that it could no longer be erased.
Yeah, that really stood out to me, and just the amount of different women that were leaders in across the spectrum of the groups that you focus on. The other thing that stood out to me big time was the use of visual imagery throughout the text. And I was wondering if you could just speak a little bit about why you included the images that you did, not each and every one, but what did you hope the reader would get out of seeing so many visuals in a community history?
My hope, I actually wish I would have probably put more in there. And I was finalizing the manuscript during the pandemic, and so I was just like, I need to just get the, and I was up for it. And so the thing was, and I'm looking at them on my bookcase. I have all of the issues that were printed of the Rican Journal, because the founder and editor, Samuel Betances, when I recorded his oral history, gifted me. I had already bought a couple of them online that I found that I don't even know how I found the Rican Journal. And then he gifted me the other ones, but the covers are all beautiful, right? There's actually ex an exhibit right now, Entre Horizontes, at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago, that highlights a lot of these archives and what they have some of the covers on there, right, to tell our story. And I love that the curators used print culture as a way to tell the community history, right? Yes, there's amazing art installations as part of the exhibit, but one of the things that I know when I walk in and I see it, I see these covers, right? I see the front pages of the Young Lords newspaper. I see pages of El Puertorriqueño. I see the covers of the Rican. And so for other people, they're seeing it for the first time. And for me, for the first time, I feel at home in these, very white museum spaces, because they're using what we created to tell our histories, right? And so these covers are incredible representation of how the community was seeing them, if people are interested in them, try to look these covers up for the Rican Journal, because they're important, like these visuals, but also with the Young Lords newspapers, which DePaul University has them all digitized. People can visit them and engage with them. I think it's really important for people to see these imageries, right? These images as telling a story on their own. I'm actually doing or helping put together an exhibit on our campus on the history of Latino students at the University of Illinois. And I'm actually using the covers of the student newspapers as a way to document our stories and histories in that spaces, because it's a really good reminder that we don't need other people to tell us how we see ourselves. This is how we see ourselves in these spaces. And print materials, especially, from the 60s and 70s, are incredible archives in their own. And my hope is that more people start engaging with these images to tell a story. I'm not an art historian, right? And so I know that I can't use them in the same ways that some of my colleagues can, right? But including them was really, really important, so that these aren't just, abstract things I'm talking about. No, these are materials that are material possessions that our communities have too.
Yeah, I think they came out beautifully. I wish I could have seen them in color, honestly. I think that would have been really amazing. So I think we talked a little about why Chicago. Obviously, you have connection to Chicago. But I was wondering if you could just what lessons do you think we can draw from this history that applies beyond Chicago? And that could be for the Puerto Rican schooling experience, but also just larger themes like, one of the big things that comes out to me is this struggle for American citizenship and the role that schooling plays in defining who is, who can become, what that looks like. So where do you see the Chicago story in a larger story of schooling, US schooling?
It's an ongoing story, right? That every generation of students, right, of Puerto Rican students, that's just what my work is centered in, is a different one, because they are experienced colonialism, dispossession in different waves, right? And so, when we think about dispossession, we're usually, thinking about people's relationship to places, like spaces, but schools are also a form of dispossession, right? Because we're not present in the curriculum, we're not being taught by our own community members. And that's important, right? And but we experience it really, really different. How I experienced it, you know, entering Chicago public schools in the 80s, is going to be really different than what a Puerto Rican child who was dispossessed because of Hurricane Maria and is now living in Chicago or in other places is going to experience it, right? Either way, though, these stories matter. And there's so many pedagogical tools, right? There's so many interventions that our communities are making if people just listened, right? You know, what? How do we shift? You know, everyone's talking about diversity and equity, but our communities were doing that work when, you know, our mothers, our grandmothers, our tías were DEI officers themselves when they're standing at, you know, board meetings in the 1960s and 70s fighting for their children, their community children to have a seat at the table, but they're not credited, right? And so I, you know, my hope is that one of the takeaways is for people to really interrogate schooling histories within our communities as a tool, one, to know that we're already doing this. We've been done telling y'all that, you know, this is what you need to do in order to create equitable spaces for our community. You just weren't listening to us because we didn't have titles, right? And so, but the thing is, when you're writing these histories, it turns out, no, actually, some people did have titles. Maria Celda did have a title, you know. These were all college-educated women that I highlight in the book, right? Mm-hmm. So, but you just discredit them. And so what would it look like if we go back to these historical moments and use that as very effective tools to engage in transformative work in our school spaces now? The problem is, in a place like Chicago, is because of we're back to urban renewal and gentrification, which is what the community was fighting in the 50s
and 60s. Right, which we see very clearly, very clearly.
We're being displaced in such ways that the cohesiveness of communities break down, right? Because you know, when you look at Pilsen, you know, in the Mexican community, when people leave Pilsen, then where are they going, right? Where is the Mexican population going? What schools are they going to? You're breaking up like the cohesiveness, the networks that people have fought and created in these community spaces. And that's going to affect schools in a lot of different ways because you no longer have those individuals there who are going to be advocating and creating, right? And so, you know, my hope is that people can look at the book, you know, but then look at other works, similar works that are also engaging in these conversations as a reminder that we've already done the work. We have been doing this work. You just listening to us, but now what are you learning from it to engage in effective, you know, transformations of our schools in our communities too?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's really important. You know, the buzzwords of today, they signify something that's new. But as your history, and I think a lot of other histories, particularly social histories, tell us, this work is ongoing. The struggle has not begun in 2020. There's a long, deep history there. And I think it's really, that's one of the important things I think the book makes clear, is just how important this work is to a community that is not considered to be part of the larger community in which it's being literally forced to be a part of.
You know, when I teach my history of U.S. education classes, I'm very intentional of, you know, there's things you're supposed to know, right? Foundational. And I spend maybe like 1 or 2 weeks giving students like readings, but all of the texts that students, I'm teaching a class this semester too, all of the texts that students are reading are about or written by communities of color, right? And so I'm telling you the history of U.S. education. I'm just not using, you know, the scholarship that in many ways negates us a sense of belonging in these spaces. No, I'm using Jim Anderson's History of Black Education, right? I'm using, you know, Yun Pak's work on Japanese American students in internment camps, right? I'm looking at using Brenda Child's boarding school seasons, right, to talk about Indigenous education and displacement, right? No, this is U.S. history, right? A sub, you know, field. This is U.S. educational history, but you have to learn it from the people who were at the receiving end of all of these policies too.
Yeah, I think it's vitally important. And I think that that larger question of how is history education taught is another, you know, fascinating thing that I think is going to be interrogated more and more, especially as more works like yours come out, as far as you can't just tell the story from the perspective of the people who are in dominance in society. It has to be people who are on the receiving end, as you're saying. One of the things that struck me too, and I think I see this in a lot of Latino, Latina, Latinx work, is this, you describe the flow of migrants, forced entry to Chicago in terms of waves. And I was just wondering if you could just reflect a little bit on, what do you think that metaphor means for the Latino community at large, and also just like, why did you use that metaphor to describe the immigrants? I just found that, I don't know, it speaks to me, just the notion of waves, you know?
And I have a love-hate relationship with even using the language of waves, And it's primarily been used when talking about Cuban migration, right? Which is a different complicated conversation about how immigration, you know, dispossession.
That's how I got here. So I think that's why it spoke to me.
Complicated and different.
Yeah, right.
However, I'm also thinking about Hawaiian indigenous scholars who talk a lot about water.
Right.
And so that's the way that I'm thinking about it now. I'm not thinking about it in waves, in the ways in which, you know, U.S. history, you know, has talked about, like, movements of,
the three waves of Cubanos.
I'm trying to move away from that, mm-hmm. but thinking about it more in relationship to movement and water and our connection to our home, right? And so water comes to signify something very important to me, right? Because of our relationship to displacement, right? And separation from home. And then with Hurricane Maria, now water means something very different to us too. And so I've been thinking a lot about that, about our movement in relationship to what does it mean to be on a wave in itself, right? This idea that, you know, waves represent something that's been there before, mm-hmm. Right? Like this coming and going, right? That it's always in relationship. It's not just something that happens once and it pulls back, but it comes back both different, but carrying something of the same. And so the movement of Puerto Ricans to Chicago, even though it's happening in those quote unquote waves, right? Is something that's signified by things that come, are taken away, but also bring something back with them, right? And so there was a period of time where you have a lot of return migration back to Puerto Rico, but then people kind of coming and going, which, you know, that's a different history that also needs to be written in terms of people who went back to Puerto Rico and entered schools there, right? And Chacha Jimenez was one of those people, right? But then comes back to Chicago. And so, you know, this idea of waves have to be kind of unpacked just a little bit, right? Because again, these waves of migration are in relationship with both spaces. And I think we disconnect it sometimes when we write, especially when it comes to Cuban migration, that people assume that there's a disconnect. Once people come, ahí se quedan, right? Like that there's no relationship to home. When waves are transnational, right? They're circular.
Typical too. Like they really go in circles.
Yes. And so that's how I'm starting to think about it, right? Because those earlier movements, right, when you're thinking about, and I'm talking like 1940s, like, you know, movement because of University of Chicago, right? The mm-hmm. women that I talk about early in the book, right? I think that's important, right? Because they're always thinking about Puerto Rico, right? And so they're not thought of as a wave in itself, but they get absorbed by the labor migration that's happening very early on because they're building community with these workers, right? And then they're able to use their resources to enact change, right? And so even though they're not part of that wave or thought of, they absorb themselves, right? Because water does absorb, mm-hmm. you know, it's absorbed. And so I'm starting to think a little more differently about how we, you know, don't just view these as separate movements, but think of them in relationship, right? You know, you need those earlier migrants to then inform how the subsequent, you know, movement, the people that are coming, where they're coming to too, right? Because now they need communities to move into, but then they also need community resources, right? You know, what the Caballeros de San Juan bill or trying to do is going to have an effect on the migrants that are coming in the 1960s and 70s too.
Yeah, and I think that was beautifully said. I think that's really beautifully said. I'm just going to leave that there. I think that was beautifully said. There's so many rich stories in here. It's really incredible. I think just the amount of different little battles that are going on within Chicago, within intrapolitics of the Puerto Ricans themselves and the different factions. So, you know, especially the fact that you're from there, you're Puerto Rican. What do you think? What did you learn? What came out? What surprised you the most of digging into this, you know, mid 20th century history that's pretty close to, I would assume, who you are and also who you associate with? What came out and surprised you the most by, you know, by completing this study?
You
as
know,
far as the activism is concerned, the intrapolitics, those types of things. I think the Puerto Rican schooling, you know, is a little bit more abstract, but the community ground level stuff, was there something that was like, oh, I didn't know that prior?
I know most of it, right? Like, mm-hmm. I knew how I experienced it as a child looking at everything around me in Humboldt Park, right? I lived, right. You know, like off of, you know, our first, you know, landing, right, in Chicago is Francisco and North Avenue, right? Which our playground was the park. There was a playground literally like right across street, North Avenue. And so if we wanted to go to the park, we just crossed this big street, right? And I recently drove by it. I think one of my daughters was visiting and I'm like, oh, wait, let's go drive by it, you know? And so I was experiencing everything, right? I marched in the Puerto Rican Day Parade as a child because Ms. Navarro would take us, right? I end up joining Aspira of Illinois as a high school student because I needed someone to help me apply for college and help me with my financial aid. And so I was an aspirante, right? I had Ms. Navarro as my teacher, right? I went to the restaurants and to the food trucks in the park. So I experienced everything in that community as a young person, right? Then went away to college without knowing that everything I was experiencing was a consequence of something, right? Mm-hmm. I had a Puerto Rican teacher because, you know, they were trying to transform the community, you know, wanted to make sure that there were Puerto Rican teachers teaching in our spaces, right? And so I'm inheriting, you know, what's happening. And Ms. Navarro inherited that too, because she did tell me that one of the first things that she witnessed when she came was the 1977 uprising. Mm-hmm. She was walking through a park and she's like, okay, something's happening. And that the whole time she was thinking about the safety of her kids, making sure that when she was looking around, she was making sure she didn't see any of her school, like her classroom kids, in the middle of everything that was happening, right? That she was scared for them, right? And so she experienced that, right? And so I didn't know that the reason why when my older sister and I were walking down Division Street, there were all of these empty buildings. I was eight, not asking questions. I didn't know that the reason these buildings were all abandoned, you know, by the early 1980s was because of that history, right? I was just experiencing it, right? Mm-hmm. And it took leaving to then start asking questions about why these systems existed when I was a child, right? Why these places? I just knew that I was Puerto Rican and I grew up in a Puerto Rican community and that every store was owned by a Puerto Rican. And, you know, my doctor was Cuban, you know, like that I lived in a Spanish-speaking community, and that there was no questions about it. Now, what I did know is that there are people out there who had better opportunities than me, because when you start playing sports or start, you know, joining all, you know, your experience in schools tell you firsthand that, oh, wait, there's people who have things that are nicer. Or if you jumped on the train or the bus and you passed by all these neighborhoods, to me, like, I remember we would go past like DePaul and go through Lincoln Park, like on our way somewhere. And my idea of making it was I'm going to live in one of these brownstones one day. And I remember saying that to myself as a kid. And then I realized, I find out, oh, they have that because they displaced Puerto Ricans. And so I think about like what I was aspiring to do or wanted, because this is what we're taught to want that. I would never live there now. I can't afford it, but then also like I would never want to live there. I think about that. I think about my dispossession was creating the opportunities for other people, or they dispossessed us in order to have a better life for themselves. And so, you know, I actually kind of like that I didn't grow up knowing this firsthand as a child, that I was just living it, right? I knew, you know, like to this day, like I tell my students, I go, your grandparents probably talk about the fact that their garbage hasn't been picked up the same since Harold Washington, right? And so like my dad died still saying that, right? Like, oh, you know, mira la basura si estaba Harold Washington. I'm like, well, also Harold Washington wouldn't be alive. Had he not died, he probably would not be like still making sure that your garbage was being picked up. But there's a way in which that's how I experienced it, right? Like I grew up, you know, like my mom volunteering to work, you know, at the voting places, right? And also campaigning for Luis Gutierrez for his first, you know, run for office very, like as a child, I remember that, right? And then fast forward, you know, Luis Gutierrez, I was teaching Luis Gutierrez's daughter when she was an undergraduate student, right? And he was the keynote for my high school graduation, but then also my PhD graduation. So like, I love that I lived my life as a Puerto Rican child in this community. And then fast forward, I'm writing about it in a very specific way, and it's answering my own questions about why it is I'm so grounded in my identity is because of this history, and because of my relationship to the space, right? I wear a ring that has the coordinates to Humboldt Park, right? As a reminder of the places that informed who I am, but then also my dedication to the community, even if I'm doing it from behind the scenes, right? You know, even if now I get to teach kids 2 hours south of Chicago on a campus who are walking into my classrooms wearing Humboldt Park t-shirts, right? And they get super excited. They're like, oh, someone told me you're Puerto Rican and that you grew up in Humboldt Park. I'm like, I did grow up in Humboldt Park, right? Mm-hmm. So I love those interactions now. And now they're learning about the history. I'm also going to go broke because I'll be like, let me buy you a copy of the book so you have your history. But one student actually came and said, my dad saw your book somewhere and bought it. And then I realized you were here. And my dad's like, you have to take a class with her. She told my history. You have to go learn from her. And so I love those connections that at the end of the day, even in the middle of the cornfields while I'm teaching, I'm still connected to my community in so many different ways.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Yeah, that in the middle of the cornfields, hearing the connection to Puerto Rican Chicago, that's something that's really special. And I think, you know, to kind of wrap up a little bit here, I think this is an incredibly important book within the field. And I know we were talking a little bit in the beginning about some new directions, but specifically for the Latinx field within the history of education. Where do you see the field now that this book is out? There's a couple other books that are starting to come out. Where do you see the field now, and where do you see it going, I guess?
If we're talking about the history of Latino education, I don't know. I don't know if they're always received in the same way as other people are because of, you know, and I'm sure there's colleagues in the field who are like, oh, no, don't say it. But I think that it's still a struggle to not just be seen as these sub, you know, texts, right? Mm-hmm. And that for people to understand that, no, these need to become foundational in the field if we're actually telling the full story of the history of U.S. education. And I don't know if we're there yet. I don't know. It shouldn't have been 2022 before the first history of Puerto Rican education in the diaspora book came out. Like, yeah. I shouldn't have written the first one. I really shouldn't have. Yeah. But I think about who didn't get to write those books, who didn't have the space to do it. I'm very, very lucky in terms of my genealogy as a historian of education that I came from a department in a space that was very intentional about cultivating a culture of inclusivity, but also making sure that we can tell our stories. And part of it is because, you know, Jim Anderson probably remembers sitting in a classroom and being told that you know, why are you writing the history of Black education, right? And so that he created a space in which we all can do this work, and that it wasn't just allowed, you know, but that it was supported by and being in conversation and relationship with one another, that we're still thinking together, like a whole generation of us. And now that we're advising our own students and moving on to different spaces, we're carrying that tradition with us. My hope is that the field is listening, right? That we're engaging. But then at the end of the day, why a lot of us do this work is for one another, for our communities, right? And so that, whether in the next few years, you know, like our books become part of the canon, I don't care, because my commitment is more grounded in making those connections with the next generation of students who know what it's like to not read about themselves, but help support you all in thinking about your family histories, your community histories as being important contributions to the field, even if other people. And I always have a student in my classes now who maybe hearing about the Bracero program, they're like, I went home and my grandmother said, oh, tu abuelo was a Bracero. And they're like, what? And so then I let them do an oral history, or they start collecting the documents, their family. You know, I had a student last semester whose family or father was involved in the 1992 Latino student uprising that happened on the campus of University of Illinois. And now she's my student, right? And so that they're seeing themselves, right? But now we're having to cultivate a space in these classrooms where our histories are not something that you should be learning about when you're 30 years old, 40 years old, right? But it's something that you get to see being included as part of your own educational experience. And so my hope is that the field is paying attention, right? But also doing it in a way that, it's not just, you know, an intellectual version of a DEI effort, right? That it's because it's important on its own.
Right. That I think the most important thing, it is U.S. history. It's not
U.S. history.
U.S. history. It is U.S. history.
I have constant arguments when someone's like, oh, you do. And I go, no, we're Americanist.
Right.
This is what we're doing. Right. Like, I know your history, you know.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and, you know, I think the best thing that the book pulls out, for me at least, was you can feel your connection to the story, but you can also, even if you're a hyphenated American of any sort, I think you can see why this is incredibly important, because those stories have to be told as part of the larger conversation that we're having. Because if not, we miss not only the rich details and the activism and the strength and the struggle, but we also miss the inclusion of the experiences of the people who are actually in this country, like you're saying, that the students come in. Like, that, I think that means everything. And that is, you know, a pillar of education. It is the pillar of education.
It should be. That connection, yeah, know? It should be.
You know, as I think we're at the end of our conversations today, one of the proverbial things we do at the MBN is ask any future projects that you're working on that you would like to share. So if, you know, if there's anything in the works that you would like to talk about.
Yeah, I'm hoping my second book is institutional history. Well, originally it was supposed to be mapping out Latina activism across higher ed institutions in the Midwest. And I started to do some of that work, and I'm like, that's a lot of work, right?
That sounded like a lot. It sounds like a lot.
It's a lot. Right? And so then
that's,
I started.
That's fascinating, though. I will say that. Let's just sound like that. That's a tall order.
And the first institution I was going to write about is actually my alma mater, which I'm back at, right? And so I was going to write about the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and going backwards from 1992, which was a, you know, student protest that happened. That was that moment where it's like, we enough, right? Like, this is enough, right? And I enter as an undergrad the following year, so I inherited that, history. I got to go to school there because these students took over a building and called out the institution for the way that they were being treated, Latina, Latino students. And so I decided I'm doing an institutional history, very similar to what Sharon Lee did. And, you know, her book is out of Rutgers, and looking at the University of Illinois, looking at Asian American students, Joy Williamson's book on Black student activism at University of Illinois. And so I'm going to do an institutional history that begins in the late 1960s with the first, you know, wave, the first wave of like students of color that were coming to the institution in larger numbers, and mapping out that history. And part of what I'm, you know, hoping to do, and what I'm hoping students that I'm now teaching are going to get out of it is that we've always been part of these spaces, right? But also the reason you get to take a class in Latina, Latino studies and being taught by people from your community is because students, you know, decades ago took a chance and started calling out, you know, these practices that happen in higher education that negate us spaces in these institutions. And so the second book is going to, you know, look at the history from 1970 to 1992 at the University of Illinois. And this year is the 50th anniversary of La Casa Cultural Latina, our cultural house. And the fact that I gave a student a project and I said, okay, go look at what's on 510 East Chalmers. And only one student went to go look and came back and said, it's just a parking lot. And I said, that was the original cultural house and the original department. It's a parking lot. Like our original history is no longer there.
It was literally paved.
And so, you know, and the student was like, why? And so I said, I'm going to answer that in my next book. I'm going to tell right in the next book. And so I'm going to probably start the book with an image of that paved space and remind people that just because there's nothing there doesn't mean that we come from nothing, because we don't.
That's powerful. That's powerful. I'm super excited. Midasi, thank you for your time for today. It was beautiful talking about your book, Puerto Rican Chicago, Schooling the City in 1940 and 1977. And thank you for, you know, telling a story that is important not only in the history of education, but as a person who has a complicated relationship with American citizenship. This book provides us with an image, language, stories that resonate with people who may sit sometimes on the margins of American citizenship. So thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Of course.